This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Modern piracy is a problem on the high seas, and it's even a bigger problem in the courtroom. And sometimes pirates are captured and put in jail. Other times they might be disarmed and sent on their way. And truth is, nobody knows what to do with pirates, due in part because of the unique circumstances of shipping between countries and then through international waters. Researchers from NC State University have studied the question, and they have found perhaps we have too many laws, and it makes dealing with piracy nearly impossible for many countries. Here in the studio to tell us about their findings are Mark Nance and Michael Struitt, both assistant professors of political science at NC State. Both of you, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to be here.
So when we talk about pirates, Michael, I mean, who are they? Who is a pirate? How do you define it?
Sure. Well, the place to start is probably with the international law definition. And under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, piracy is a crime that can only occur in what's called the high seas, which is a technical legal term, meaning the space on the oceans that's more than 12 miles from the coast of any territorial states. So if you rob a boat in somebody's territorial waters, it's actually not technically piracy at all. But then there are other legal instruments that make it a crime to attack a boat in that situation. Those are mostly terrorist treaties, such as the so-called Suez Convention. And so the legal sort of landscape for exactly who becomes a pirate under what circumstances is very complex.
All right. So now we're out on the high seas. You've taken my cargo. You're definitely a pirate now. This is international waters we're talking about, right?
Yes.
So, Mark, what makes it hard then? If I had some cargo on that ship, couldn't the United States say, you stole something that belonged to a United States citizen? We're taking you back to court. We're going to try you.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it does seem like piracy, I think, is an easy problem to solve. But I think if you look at the number of countries and the interests that are involved in there, it becomes very complex. If you take this hypothetical example, there's the flags of convenience regime, which basically means that the territorial sovereignty of the states that whose flags are on the ships extends to that ship itself. And so this is sort of Panama, for example, Liberia, some others are hold the vast majority of these ships. So the United States in this case would have to deal with that state and its concern. There are the states who represent the various sort of multinational corporations who own the goods on the ship itself. So there's that level. Then there's the nationality of the merchant mariners themselves, which come from other countries still. And then finally, if any of this does happen to sort of run into territorial waters, you then have yet another level of interest there. And so it's really this dense web of states that are involved, all of whom have different interests in it. And so it's a very tangled mess that you get into.
But that tangled mess seems to have been with us for a long time. I mean, that is the story of shipping. Are there no international agreements? Haven't people put their heads together to say, okay, let's sort this out?
Yeah, well, the UNCLOS convention basically is very permissive. It allows states to arrest people that are engaged in piracy or that have committed piratical acts. You can seize their equipment, and you may prosecute them under your national laws, but it's discretionary. And the effect of that is that many times states choose, precisely because of the sort of complex set of interests that make it confusing to figure out a particular situation on the ground, they simply choose to take the pirates' guns and let them go. But that only happens sometimes. Now, the United States has been very protective of the U.S. flag. So in the few cases like the Maersk Alabama, where that was a U.S. flagged container ship, or in the case of these private yachts that were flying under U.S. flags, we've seen the U.S. Navy act very aggressively because there it's a clearer case of U.S. sovereignty being attacked. But because most of the shipping, even for goods and services that are ultimately destined to the United States, doesn't sail under the U.S. flag, that is often not what happens. And the net effect of all this is it's very difficult for any person involved in the shipping industry or for a Navy captain or for police authorities or for prosecutors to know how a particular piratical incident is going to play out because people's behavior is just not standardized or there's no expectation about what's going to happen
next. You can kind of imagine people getting together and saying, okay, here's the law. This is a new form of piracy, and here's the landscape or the seascape. Let's work it out. But it seems to me policing would be the real problem. Who's going to be the police force on the high seas to stop these? Not going to be the Liberians or the Panamanians under whose flag most of these ships
That's right. Sale. And that's one of the problems of the flags, one of the many problems, arguably, of the flags of convenience issue, that those states whose flag is on most of the ships don't have the capacity, anywhere near the capacity to do it. But there's some debate about whether anybody really has the capacity. We're talking sort of vast areas, and it's much more difficult than the needle in a haystack problem. I mean, there are some 20 navies right now off the Horn of Africa patrolling, but they're still covering. I mean, they're going after very small boats, and so the territory they're trying to cover is very difficult. So there have been some efforts to coordinate among the EU and the US and some other sort of navies. But again, it's you have, because of these rules about engagement, you have to make sure the right ship is getting to the right, let's call it, piratical event at the right time.
Piratical event. You, like, you know, that phrase has never been used on this show.
I'm happy to have that first.
Let's mark that one, Robin. That goes on the Christmas tape. So the piratical event, you have to know which it is and how to define it. And does it matter then in this event where the booty is going? Does it matter if it's just being stolen and used by pirates, or if it's going? We've heard a little bit about perhaps terrorist networks using it.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of different kinds of piracy. Some things are started as very low-scale events where, you know, people that were maybe making their living as coastal fishermen suddenly find there's not enough fish, and so they turn to robbing cash or maybe even paint or rope off of passing ships, right? And then there's a whole nother level of piracy where people are seizing these large container vessels, particularly in Southeast Asia. One of the common models was to literally take control of the ship, reflag it, and re-register it in a legal environment that was maybe more permissive. For a while, that was Southeast China, Shanghai. And, you know, then that vessel can go on to be engaged in smuggling around the world, for example, and that would be part of a much larger criminal enterprise, right? So piracy really varies in that dimension as well.
How well trained are the pirates? Wouldn't it be easy for a cargo vessel simply to protect themselves against being boarded and losing cargo?
Well, it seems like that, and there are a couple of problems with that, though. Again, as Michael was saying, some of them are better trained than others. We don't really know, and this is one of the problems with the catch-and-release approach that states are using right now. We don't really know as much as we need to know about pirates to understand who they are and how well-trained they are. But it's not that hard to take over a ship, strangely enough, and part of it is because they're not really allowed to be armed themselves. Because ports, for example, aren't interested in having ships roll in with lots of heavily armed people on them. And so there's some objections to that, to that solution. If you take the Strait of Malacca in particular as an example, which is where sort of a lot of piracy used to happen before it shifted really off to the Horn of Africa, and it still is a problem in the Straits. That's so narrow that they don't really have the maneuver. You can maneuver, for example. They suggest that ships zigzag to try to avoid pirates, but they don't have the physical space to do that within the Straits. And so in that regard, those are two sort of basic restrictions on why the ships themselves are sort of sitting ducks, if you will.
And how well organized are pirates? Are there syndicates? This could be a good investment for somebody.
Sure,
right?
Some of them certainly are. And in fact, we've seen that in the Somali case. There was a story that some of the Somali villages that were engaged in piracy were actually taking shareholders, where if you sort of paid for a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, that you could invest essentially in the outcome of a piratical attack. So they're large enterprises. The frequent ransoms are up to probably $3 million to release the crew or to release some of these larger shipping vessels. And that money is being transferred, and it's clear when it shows up in Somalia that sort of suddenly per capita spending goes up. But it's also likely that most of the money is not filtering back to that Somali village. There's, you know, some larger criminal gangs and you know, organized elements behind it that may not even be in the Somalia region, right?
So not a lot of Robin Blackbeards in the group. So what about in the old days when, you know, piracy grew to be famous and romantic? How is it dealt with then, and can any of that be a model for us now?
Well, that's been some of the discussion, I think. People tend to respond to this often and by saying, why don't we just shoot them, right? Hang them on sight. And I think in theory, we've the sort of international norms have progressed, evolved, I would argue, past that, so that we don't really like the idea of denying due process entirely. But even from a more self-interested perspective, I think the Navy, most navies are not interested in having the seas become sort of the Wild West lawless area that it used to be. And I think they've been behind reinforcing a lot of the rules that do apply in the international sea. So it's really nobody's interest.
Well, and you could imagine if the definition of piracy is as slippery as it is, you could argue that you taking those resources from our ground amounted to some form of theft. We're taking it back if you're some kind of a developing country from whom we've extracted resources.
Sure, and some of the Somali sort of pirates have made that argument that, in fact, there's a form of a coastal police force of some sort, and that they're entitled to do this. This goes to the sort of resource expenditure issue, though, that's clearly part of this piracy problem. Mm. Often the coastal states simply don't have the resources to engage in the policing and the prosecution that really needs to be done. But there's a question of sort of burden sharing and how those costs should be shared. And that's where I think that the sort of advanced industrial economies that really benefit so tremendously from the trillion plus dollars a year in goods and services that are traded around the world have an obligation to sort of pay more of their share. There was this model to build a piracy court and prison in Kenya, which seemed promising, but as soon as there were 200 Somali pirates in that prison, the Kenyans sort of lost interest.
Michael Struitt and Mark Nance, thank you both for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Michael Struitt and Mark Nance, assistant professors of political science at NC State University. Just ahead, we will talk about public memory of North Carolina's textile mills on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us.